I think we have a lot of slides to go through. We don't have to go through all of them. So what I'm going to do is we can make this interactive. You know, feel free to interrupt me. We just kind of breeze through the slides and focus on things that interest you. So, please feel free to interject. So it's really trying to encapsulate the whole of prostate cancer the best I could. Okay, so I think what we want to try to get through is the epidemiology, screening, and prevention. Risk stratification, which I think is actually extremely, extremely important, at least from a clinical perspective. And also how we can use basic science to influence that would be great. Now, I didn't dwell a whole lot in epidemiology. I mean, that's not my area of research interest, but clearly it's important. Then I'll talk about treatment of early and high-risk disease, and we can make it as short or as long as you want it to be. I think we really should focus on hormonal therapy. That's, at the end of the day, the bread and butter of advanced prostate cancer treatment, and actually keep on moving it on earlier on, especially if you're trying to cure patients. And then, talk briefly about the treatment of advanced disease, because I think that's a particular challenge. And right towards the end, I have a bunch of slides which are loosely labeled as, recent advances. But most of them have to do, with what we are learning about the molecular taxonomy of prostate cancer, what are the changes in advanced stage disease, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so I guess all of you are familiar with these numbers. The main thing I really wanted to bring up here is that with screening going down, the total number of new cases are diminishing. And for this year, actually, what's projected is about 180,000 cases, new cases and 26 deaths. And if you look at the next slide, if you look at 2015, it was actually 220,000. So that's a pretty dramatic shift in just a year. And if you look at the guidelines which came out against advocating for screening for everybody, they only came out in 2012. So I think this has been pretty precipitous. The other thing I just want to highlight here is, very often when you go to the SEER database, and that's where this is from, they talk about so many new cases per 100,000 population, which is always going to be less than the total number of new cases. So for instance, for 2015, what you see is the total number of new cases per 100,000 patients is somewhere about 130, 140, but in truth, the total number of new cases were 220. So just kind of need to be aware of that when you're looking at data. The total deaths were 27,000 something, this year 26,000 something, and if you go back to the pre-screening era, or regular pre-screening PSA era, it used to be more like about 40,000 deaths. So if you take a 20-year snapshot, we have probably gone down from 40,000 deaths a year to about 25, 26,000 a year. And for the advocates of screening, I think that's kind of been the biggest thing that they have advocated, that's the main reason they've advocated for screening. But clearly we have to screen a whole lot of patients to kind of come up to prevent, a significant number of deaths. So I think there's a huge imbalance. And I think the biggest reason I think screening has been dinged is just because you diagnose doesn't really mean you need to treat everybody. Right? So there's a lot of unnecessary diagnosis, or rather over-diagnosis, over-treatment, and I think in general for cancer, for cancer, I think the dictum these days is, more is less, just as a general truism. But anyway. This just talks about 5-year relative survival by diagnosis, and since prostate is a fairly long life cycle or life history, it's no surprise that at 5 years, if you diagnose people early, survival is 100%. So that also makes prostate a more challenging disease, especially in the advanced setting when you're trying to come up with cures or life-altering or life-curing therapies. It takes a very long time to find out. So that's why I think trying to do a prevention trial would be a very impractical thing. It'll probably, the length of the study and the eventual data will probably far outstrip investigators' lifespan. Useful lifespan. I mean, I don't mean absolute lifespan, at least the investigator lifespan. So what are the risk factors? Clearly you have to be a male. Otherwise it's hard to get prostate cancer, if not impossible. Aging clearly has a link to prostate cancer, whether it's just a function of having it around for a long time or whether there's something biologic there is unclear. I think about 6-7 years ago, one of the fashionable theories was that as we get older, relatively speaking, our testosterone goes down. And so, relatively speaking, the estrogen goes up. So it's this ET, this differential in the ET ratio, which is the carcinogenic event. And then obviously you need androgens to foster the disease. So it's not quite panned out, but it's not been completely disproven either. And so this ET, the relative imbalance in the ET ratio, at least according to some people, is still thought to be perhaps an explanation for why we get prostate cancer as we age. Then race and ethnic background, dietary factors, all of those have an impact, not very well known. Same thing with androgen levels. Whether you're more prone to developing cancer if you have high T levels or high testosterone levels is not 100% clear, because there's serum testosterone and then there's tumor testosterone, and those levels can be very different. So again, these are all areas of investigation. But clearly we're learning much more about the genetic factors. So again, this just speaks to the importance of age. So median age at diagnosis is 66. If you go back 10 years, the median age of diagnosis was even a little higher, because 10, 15 years ago, we did not screen people that avidly. And again, if you look at death, the median age at death is 80 years. So since it's an elderly population which gets this cancer, and since the whole life cycle of prostate cancer is long, again, that's not a surprise. Race, again, has a big impact. So again, if you look at this slide, the number of new cases amongst African Americans or blacks are almost twofold higher than most populations, except perhaps Hispanics. But I think if you look at the next slide, which talks about the number of deaths, the deaths per 100,000 population are almost 2.5 to 3-fold higher in blacks as opposed to other populations, which I think speaks to there may be one of the reasons may be access and people are being diagnosed late, but clearly there's also something biologically different, and again that's been studied a lot by disparities researchers as well. So a number of dietary factors have been invoked and looked at, but the truth is, other than a high-fat diet, we really don't have any clear-cut, causal dietary factor that I'm aware of. And family history clearly has a role. So the younger the age of diagnosis of the index case, the higher the risk to subsequent family members, and also it goes up with the number of family members involved. So for instance, if you have one family member under the age of 60 or 65 with prostate cancer, the males in that generation probably have a twofold higher risk. And then I think if it's 2 to 3 members, it goes up 5 or 7-fold. So it kind of goes up exponentially. Now this has been looked at, but so far there is no clear-cut familial prostate cancer gene. Chromosome 8 in the region of the MYC gene have been invoked. Certain SNPs have been associated, but again, I think as you look at the hazard ratio is not very high. So yes, in some, but there's no global association or preponderant association that we are aware of. Now again, the AR is the primary driver of prostate cancer once established, and we talk about targeted therapy. And clearly, that is the single most important target in prostate cancer. I mean, I like to contrast that with breast cancer. Yes, in ER-driven breast cancer, ER is important. But even in those women, with treatment, the ER can disappear. Whereas the AR, in 98%, 99%+ men, is always a player in fostering the disease. Not only is it a player, it's probably the primary driver of prostate cancer, both through androgen ligands as well as through non-androgen ligands. So because AR is promiscuous and can talk to many different ligands. So I think this is an important paper, especially for this audience. This kind of came out last year, and essentially they looked at data from they looked at the molecular data from 333 primary prostate cancers that were sequenced, and what they came up with was that at least about 60% of them have this, you know, fusions of the ERG gene with different members of the ETS family of transcription factors. And then, you know, the rest of them, you know, either had mutations in the SPOP, FOXA1, which are both regulators of steroidogenesis as well as the androgen receptor, amongst other genes, and also the IDH1 gene, which is important in metabolism, being isolated with dehydrogenase. And then, and then again, the other molecular abnormalities were DNA hypermethylation. Clearly, the AR is a big player, and what we are finding is that at least in primary tumors, about 5 to 10% tend to have DNA repair defects as well. So remember, these are primary tumors. As you treat people, and as they've been exposed to a bunch of different, and we'll go into that a little later, much of different treatments, you know, the molecular flavor of the tumor changes a little bit. So the DNA repair defects go up anywhere from 5 to 10% to 20 to 30%. So I think there's this gradually evolving notion that, you know, even with prostate cancer, you can split it up into 6 or 7 molecular types. But this is probably true for about 3/4 of the cancers, so about 75%. So for 25%, there are no distinct molecular abnormalities that we know of. Now, again, they tend to be AR-driven, but, you know, other than that, there are no specific abnormalities. So in summary, that's what they came up with, 74% associated with a molecular abnormality, 7 subtypes defined by ETS fusions or mutations in SPOP, FOXA1, and IDH1, substantial epigenetic heterogeneity, including hypermethylation of IDH1, and we presume that there are actionable lesions in PI3 kinase, MAP kinase, and DNA repair pathways. You know, other than the exception of DNA repair pathways, none of the others have really been validated as legitimate targets for effective treatment of prostate cancer. So again, I think this is a evolving area. I mean, this is not the last word on this, but I mean, so the, one of the things that always stands out is about 60% of tumors, 60% of the 74%, do have ETS fusion genes. Okay. This again kind of speaks to some of the same. I think the main point I wanted to make here is they did look at a few metastatic samples, but if you look at the mutational burden, it's not terribly different from the primary tumor. So, you know, unlike lung or bladder, you know, where the mutational burden is high, presumably smoke, at least part of it being smoking-related, at least prostate, it doesn't tend to be, the mutational burden is not that high. And once again, you know, if you look at the androgen receptor, the primary abnormalities you see is amplification. You know, loss or deletions or mutations are not that common in the androgen receptor. So the one thing is it becomes very sensitive to even small amounts of ligand, ligand being androgens here, and the other thing is it does tend to be amplified. But those are the two main, you know, biological or functional things associated with that. And the incidence of, you know, DNA disrepair also is more in metastatic tissue as opposed to primary tissue. I'm not sure how much interest all this is, so I'm going to breeze through the next few slides. So I'm kind of going sequentially. You know, you go prevention, diagnosis, treatment of early disease, and then treatment of late disease. So that's going to be the sequence of the slides. So I think, people have looked at a number of things, they've looked at selenium, vitamin E, vitamin D, but the only thing that has kind of panned out so far are the 5-alpha reductase inhibitors. So, I mean, if you look at testosterone metabolism, so T is converted to DHT, which is dihydrotestosterone, which is the far more active androgen as compared to testosterone, and the enzyme responsible for that is 5-alpha reductase inhibitors. So that's the reason they tested these. So there was this prostate cancer prevention trial where they used finasteride, 18,000 men over the age of 55, at the time of entry, they, you know, all of them had a PSA of less than 3. And at 7 years, what they found was that finasteride reduced the risk of prostate cancer by 25%. But the problem was, at least a fifth of the cancers diagnosed in the finasteride arm seemingly were more aggressive. And we'll go into the Gleason score in a minute. Now, it's still contentious. Were they really truly aggressive, or was that an artifact of treatment? And I think the bias, at least now, is that that was probably more a bias of treatment. A second agent called dutasteride was also tested, and again, we had a 23% reduction in prostate cancer cases, 8,000 men, compared to placebo. Now, in this one, this did not increase the prevalence of high-grade disease in the treated arm. Now, whether that was a function of more experience with reading those slides, or whether that was truly true, we don't know. So remember, when we are reporting on the aggressiveness, that's purely based on pathology. So, on the naked eye. So a lot depended on, they were all GU or general pathologists, but what their level of comfort was is kind of unclear. But the FDA has chosen not to approve these because there's no long-term effect on survival and toxicity. So yes, you can reduce the incidence of prostate cancer. Probably what you get is not higher grade, at least that's what the bias is now, but they're not officially approved because, again, we don't know what the long-term effect on survival and toxicity is. I mean, just because you reduce the incidence of cancer, doesn't mean in the long scheme of things you're going to have a societal impact. Okay. Now, people have also looked at screening. There are like three big studies, the PLCO in the U.S. and the other two in Europe, and they're kind of summarized on the next slide. Now, in the U.S. study, there was no difference in prostate cancer mortality, but what I want to point out is median follow-up was only 7 years, which may be a little too early. In the European study, there was a 20% reduction in prostate cancer mortality. They had 160,000 men, and again, what they came up with is you need to screen 48 people to be able to prevent one death, which is not cost-effective. Then there's the Swedish study, which looked at 20,000 men, and again, they showed a 44% reduction in prostate cancer mortality. But the U.S. study was at 7 years, the pan-European study was 9 years, and the Swedish study was at 14 years of follow-up. So again, I think if you follow these up for a long time, perhaps you'll come up with a difference. The other big difference between the U.S. and the European studies was, in the U.S. studies, most of the disease was pretty early. Whereas in the European studies, men tended to have more advanced disease at diagnosis. So again, we're talking about local disease, but, a little more advanced than the U.S. So given the short follow-up, given the earlier disease, that may account for this difference. So the conclusion was low mortality of prostate cancer in the first 10 years, which nobody argues about. PSA screening probably reduces mortality, but we need longer follow-up, to make a concrete statement. But again, the big problem is large amount of overdiagnosis and overtreatment, at least in the first 10 years. So probably not worth it, and that's why the U.S. Preventive Task Force on Screening, they came out with an official recommendation in 2012 discouraging PSA-based screening. I mean, if you track the evolution of recommendations for PSA screening, the U.S. Task Force, used to equivocate, but now it's a definite no. And the two societies which have always recommended it are the American Urological Association and the American Cancer Society. But now they're kind of on the fence as well. I think what we can all agree with is it probably doesn't make sense to check a PSA every year. It may make sense to screen high-risk populations. And we probably should not screen anybody with a life expectancy of less than 10 years. Right? So I'm not just going with age as such, but, because you can have a 65-year-old with, tons of comorbidities with a life expectancy is less than 10 years. So at least in those, I think there's consensus that we should not. But whether you should screen high risk or not, I mean, all high risk, people at high risk, is unclear. So there is it's called the Stockholm 3. It's a study being conducted in Europe, and they did present preliminary data. There they use, 8, 9, 10 different variables, which essentially what they do is they put those folks at high risk, and they do screen them, and at least their preliminary results suggest that that may be a reasonable thing to do, if you use those criteria. The other thing that's been proposed is you should really start screening early, maybe 40, 45, 50. Do it for a couple of years, and if the PSA is stable, then forget it for another 5, 6 years. So I think this is an evolving field, but clearly the days of yearly PSA screening are probably definitely on the wane. That's why I showed you the first slide, where the number of new cases between 2016 and 2015, there's been a dramatic drop. Usually it was going down 250, 220, 200, but it's a drop from 220 to 180. Okay. And this again just speaks to, PSA screening, how it's kind of gone down. Okay. So how do we actually diagnose somebody with prostate cancer? So let's say it can either be driven by an abnormal PSA, or it could be driven by, so really when I'm saying diagnosis, I'm talking about a biopsy, or it could be driven by an abnormal digital rectal exam, or it could be driven by, somebody having benign prostatic hypertrophy, having a resection of their prostate, and an incidental diagnosis of cancer being made. So those are the three main routes to, and again, till now, 80% of cancers in the U.S. were PSA-driven, meaning they were either screen-driven or PSA-driven. So this is just like the anatomy of the prostate, just kind of wanted to go over that. So if you look at this, so this is a sagittal section. So most prostate cancer happens in the posterior zone. Now remember I said BPH, both BPH or benign prostatic hypertrophy and prostate cancer are androgen driven, but they're completely separate diseases, and having one does not predispose you to the other. The thing they have in common are they're androgen driven, and they happen in men, and they happen in older men. But again, just having one biologically does not make it more likely that you'll have the other. The other thing is BPH primarily happens in the median zone around the urethra. So when you do a TURP, really what you're going in is you're shaving in this area. And if you do find cancer in the prostate chips from a TURP, it doesn't preclude your having cancer in the posterior zone, which is actually where cancer arises. And that's why it's amenable to a digital rectal exam. So, 70-80% of prostate cancer is going to happen in the posterior zone. I keep on losing my mouse, sorry. 70 here, this is about 5%. And this is a particularly difficult area. About 5% of cancers arise in this area. But 70-80% are going to be in the posterior zone. Okay. Anyway, so T1s are tumors which you don't really feel on the finger. So it's a normal digital rectal exam. T2s are tumors. I'm going to try to use this, sorry. I'm not very good with the mouse. So T2s are tumors which you can feel but which you think are organ confined or are localized. T3s, they are trying to escape, so it's in the seminal vesicle. So this would be not palpable, this would be palpable but localized, and this would be palpable and locally advanced. So T1, T2, T3, and T4 is if you start involving adjacent organs or the pelvic wall. Okay. So that's how we come up with T1, T2, T3, T4. And then again, they're all, T1 is split up into A, B, and C. So A and B are really based on when somebody undergoes a TURP, and it depends on what percentage of prostate chips are positive. If it's less than 5%, it's T1A. If it's more than 5%, it's T1B. And T1Cs are the PSA-driven cancers, meaning somebody had either an elevated PSA or a rising PSA. You couldn't really feel any abnormality on a digital rectal exam. They wind up having a biopsy, and that's how they were diagnosed. And 60 to 70% of prostate cancers in the U.S. are T1C. Now, if you go back for a minute to the European study we talked about, only 30% were T1Cs and 50% were T2s. So clearly you were dealing with a little more advanced disease. Okay. And so when you're kind of interpreting results from across the Atlantic, especially for early disease, you just need to keep that in the back of your mind. T2A and T2B are again dependent on how much of the gland is involved, and T3 and T4. So T3A is a margin positive and T3B is seminal vesicle involvement. Okay. The other important metric, which you know we kind of used for 30 odd years and continue to use, is the Gleason score. And out of all the predictors that you have to predict to stratify aggressiveness of prostate cancer, this is the single most reliable metric. So the Gleason score, essentially what pathologists do look at is they look at the most common pattern or the primary pattern, and they look at the second most common pattern, and then they add them up, and they come up with, you know, 2 plus 3 or 3 plus 4 or 4 plus 5. So the Gleason pattern goes from 1 through 5 depending on the level of aggressiveness of the cancer, and the Gleason score is basically where you add the primary pattern and the secondary pattern. And at least in the academic setting, people have also made a living out of reporting tertiary patterns. You know, the question is, if you have two Gleason 8s, both 4 plus 4, why does one do well and why doesn't the other do that well? And so tertiary pattern may have a role there as well. But clearly, you know, this is an area for people looking at gene signatures. I mean, none of them are ready for prime time, but there is a 17 gene signature developed by Oncotype DX, by Genomic Health, called Oncotype DX Prostate, very similar to the breast cancer signature. It's not quite validated as yet, but they've been kind of working on that. I mean, just as a rough rule of thumb, you're probably going to have a 10% error in predicting how aggressive a cancer is going to be just based on the Gleason score. So these are the risk groups as they have traditionally existed. We still use them. So low risk is anybody less than a PSA of 10, a Gleason score of less than 7, and either a T1C or T2A. So you really have to have all those three criteria to be called low risk. As opposed to that, with intermediate and poor risk, you know, even one of those three things can tip you over. So you can have a PSA between 10 and 20, or Gleason 7, or at stage T2B. And for poor risk, it's Gleason 8 through 10, or over 7, PSA over 20, and a stage T2C or T3. So again, this is just that's what I meant by, you know, 10% of the time you're going to be wrong in the low-risk group, and 10% of the time you're going to be wrong in the high-risk, in the poor-risk group, if you just use these criteria. So clearly, these are not homogeneous groups, they're clearly heterogeneous, but as we find out more about gene signatures and validate them, I'm sure we can refine this better. And if you look at most prognostic models or most, nomograms that have been developed, the three essential elements of all those are these. So prostate cancer either spreads locally or goes to regional nodes and invariably winds up in the bones. So at least as of now, that's the only imaging we do to stage somebody, and it's only required if somebody has high-risk disease. In the intermediate setting, it's still kind of controversial. But I think most of us do wind up doing that. And just to kind of case in point there is, if you look at intermediate risk, so you have a Gleason 7, which could either be a 4 plus 3 or a 3 plus 4. And clearly we know that 3 plus 4 does much better than a 4 plus 3. So 3 being the primary pattern and 4 being the secondary pattern. And then 4 plus 3 would be the other way around. Okay, I think I kind of covered this. And the main thing, though, Oncotype DX is being used right now is to further stratify low risk and intermediate risk disease. I mean, I think almost everybody agrees if you have Gleason 8 or above, it is high risk disease and should be treated that way. And so really what I mean by low, intermediate, and high risk is, so low risk disease is something which is amenable only for local therapy. Intermediate local therapy and perhaps some systemic therapy. But if it's high risk disease, you know most of those patients clearly require both local as well as systemic therapy. So here are the treatment choices. So the other treatment, big treatment choice in low risk disease is active surveillance. So you know, you just choose to follow and based on pre-specified criteria decide when to intervene. So the downside is you do require more PSAs, you do require repeat biopsies, but you don't get any specific treatment, or you could go through surgery or go through radiation. So that would be for low-risk disease. So one of the reasons we've kind of strayed away from screening and also gotten into active surveillance is this study. So essentially what they did was they looked at about 25,000 patients at the clinic, Cleveland Clinic, Memorial Sloan Kettering, Baylor, University of Michigan, and Johns Hopkins, and they just looked at the outcome, and what they found was so these are all patients who had their prostates taken out, right? So about 10% of all cases were high risk. And their 15-year prostate cancer-specific mortality was 50%, and they represented 45% of all the cancer deaths. So this is your high-risk cancers. 40% of all cases were Gleason 7, and their 15-year mortality was only 8%. And if you look at the low-risk group, there were half the cases, and their 15-year mortality was less than 1%. So clearly, you know, we were probably treating a lot of people who didn't really need to be cured. So this is the PIVOT trial. This was done in the U.S. and was the first randomized trial to compare observation versus surgery. And what they found was at 7 years, there was no difference in the two arms. Again, this is another study which has been, you know, pivotal in swinging the pendulum from definitive treatment to active surveillance. So again, the conclusions are: among men with localized prostate cancer detected during the early era of PSA testing, radical prostatectomy does not significantly reduce prostate cancer-specific mortality. Now, there is a Scandinavian study which does show a difference. And this was also published within the last 5-6 years. And they did show a survival difference. But again, remember, I think that most of the U.S. cancers that were detected in the last decade were T1Cs and were really very early disease. Most of the European cancers, you know, tend to be slightly higher risk localized disease. For instance, if you look at their T1Cs, it's only 11%, and 76% are actually T2s. So we may just be dealing with a slightly different spectrum. And this was their data. So I think, you know, over the last 10, 12 years, because of everything we've discussed, there's been a big push towards active surveillance. And the people who really pioneered it are the Canadians in Toronto. And they recently reported on their long-term follow-up of a large cohort of patients on active surveillance. And again, if you look at their data, at 10 years, there's really no downside to doing active surveillance. You know, whether you look at, I guess the primary metric here really ought to be prostate cancer-specific mortality, and it's really no different than treating people. So I think the folks at Johns Hopkins have also been doing it, and I think the pendulum really is now for low-risk disease, it's probably going to be active surveillance. So active surveillance for favorable risk disease is feasible and safe in the 15-year time frame. Only about 2.8% of the patients develop metastatic disease, and only 1.5% died of prostate cancer, and this is consistent with expected mortality in favorable risk patients managed with initial definitive treatment which would either be surgery or radiation. And this is just a slide which talks about practice patterns in the last 10 years, and as you can see, active surveillance is picking up, surgery is going down, and radiation is going down. Okay, so now let's move on to high-risk disease. So I think the trial that really put systemic therapy or the importance of systemic therapy on the map was this trial from Europe, and the author was Bola. And what they showed was in men with high-risk disease, as we have defined earlier, if you use radiation alone and you compare it to radiation plus systemic therapy, there's almost a 20% survival difference at about 10 to 12 years. And this study has been replicated in the U.S., and at this point we have thousands and thousands of patients essentially validating that for high-risk disease, systemic treatment has a huge survival advantage, you know, in the order of about 20% or so. Now, what do I mean by systemic treatment? And that's really hormonal therapy or androgen ablation. So in this study, patients were randomized either to radiation or to radiation and 3 years of androgen deprivation therapy or hormonal therapy. In the U.S. studies, 2 years has been tested, and that's equally effective. At this point, I think what remains to be determined is what is the appropriate duration of hormonal therapy. So we know that 3 years is good, we know 2 years is good, and we know 6 months is not good enough. Is there a time point in between which is good enough? We don't know. There is one study which has been going on where they're looking at 18 months, and the data on that is not mature as yet. Okay. So this is the study which actually showed that 6 months was not good enough. So here men were randomized either to 6 months of androgen blockade or androgen deprivation therapy or to 13 months. So this was called long-term androgen deprivation therapy, and this was called short-term androgen deprivation therapy. And as you can see, the long-term androgen deprivation therapy arm was superior. Though having said that, at least at 5 years, the difference was only about 5%. Now, the thing with these studies is, even with the Bola study, initially when it was reported at 7 or 8 years, the survival difference advantage was 15%. But when we look out at 12 years, it was more like 20 to 22%. Now, the same may hold true of this, but since at 5 years, also you see a statistically significant difference, you know, at least the prevailing wisdom right now is that 6 months is definitely not enough. And in the U.S., there's been a study looking at 4 months, and we know that 4 months isn't good enough either. So till we have a definitive study, at least for now, the duration of recommended therapies is 2 to 3 years. Now, this has also been looked at patients with intermediate risk disease, and there the bias is 6 months is probably good enough. And this is based on a study done by the RTOG in the U.S. Okay. Now, this is a very controversial study. So everything I've talked about so far is in the context of radiation. In the context of surgery, people have looked at neoadjuvant studies, you know, meaning you, before taking the prostate out, you know, you treat for 3 months, 6 months, or 9 months of hormones. Actually, the 9 months of hormones was completely serendipitous because that was done in British Columbia. They had long waiting lists, and on an average, people waited 8-9 months before they had the prostate taken out. And the readout, initial readout there was a pathological complete response, at least in oncology. You know, if you throw something at somebody before their organ comes out, and if you can get a complete response in the tissue when the organ comes out, that's supposed to be a good thing. If you look at breast, bladder, colon, you know, with chemotherapy or a combination of chemo and hormones in breast, you can get a pathological CR rate of about 25 to 30%. In prostate, at least with existent androgen deprivation therapy, the pathological CR rate is no more than 5%. Now, it could be we are not castrating enough, or it could be that there's something different about prostate. So because of that, a lot of the neoadjuvant studies kind of fell out of favor, and even when you did 9 months of treatment, and then you followed these patients out after surgery, there was no survival difference. So at least in the surgical literature, you will find that doing that hormones have no role in the neoadjuvant setting, which is probably true as we know of now. Now so that was a big detriment to doing adjuvant studies as well. So, you know, in oncology, the big advantage of neoadjuvant studies is you can get a quick answer, right? So if you get a CR in your tissue at the time of surgery, you know this is a good thing to do. With adjuvant studies, you have to do them for years before you see any difference. So this is an adjuvant surgical study, which was actually done by Ed Messing, who's up in Rochester, many, many years ago. And what they did was, at the time of surgery, when they took the prostate out, they also sampled the nodes. And if on frozen, patients were node positive, they either had an orchiectomy or not, because at that time, chemical castration wasn't around. And so what you see in this is, in men who had immediate castration, meaning an orchiectomy, and you compare it to the people who were observed, again, it's the same kind of survival advantage of about 20% at 10, 12 years. But the big problem with the study was it's only 98 patients. And, you know, usually for an adjuvant study, 98 patients is really a very small number. But because the difference was so huge, 20 to 25%, it's statistically significant. So this study is quoted a lot. It's debated a lot. I personally, if somebody is node positive after surgery, I do offer them hormone therapy. Based on the surgical literature, based on the radiation oncology literature, I offer it for 2 or 3 years. But there's no consensus on this. I think if you do a prostatectomy following the surgery, if somebody's PSA is undetectable, it is not unreasonable just to follow them and only treat if and when they relapse. So this is a truly controversial area. Unfortunately, there were like two big studies in the same space, using chemotherapy and hormone therapy. But unfortunately, they were too complicated. There was a chemotherapy arm, there was a hormone arm, there was a combination arm. There were like 3,200 patients to be accrued. And the biggest flaw with the study was you had a choice. You could either get treated straight away, or you could get treated when your PSA came up to 0.2. So in the surgical literature, when you take the prostate out, a cure is a PSA less than 0.1. A detectable PSA is 0.2, but a relapse is more than 0.2. So the design of the study was that you could go, you could either went to those three arms, or you went to those three arms when your PSA went to 0.2. So in effect, it became a six-arm study with 3,200 patients. So that's the problem with doing ambitious studies. And most patients wanted to know, I really don't want hormones, but will you treat me when my PSA goes up? So they never enrolled. So the study kind of was terminated prematurely. So we never got the answer. That's really what I'm saying. In a long-winded way. Okay. So now let's move on to the natural history of prostate cancer. So after local therapy, on an average about 40%, 35-40% men will relapse. And the only thing you have is their PSA going up. So as the PSA goes up, somewhere along the course, they will see androgen deprivation therapy. And I'll kind of go into that in a second, or the details thereof. And eventually, people will fail that. And they used to see chemotherapy, but now life has gotten complicated and there are many other options. And then they'd fail chemotherapy, and their survival used to be fairly short. So first off, this is like a 15 to 20 plus year journey. Could be more depending on the biology of your disease. And throughout this period, the AR is always functional and a target. So when you manipulate the AR, you can split up patients into castrate sensitive or castrate resistant. They can either be non-metastatic or they can be metastatic. Remember what I said here was the first sign of the disease coming back is the PSA going up. And so, we pick up people early, we treat them early, they relapse early. So there's a huge population of men with PSA-only disease with no evidence of metastasis. And because of the fact that we treat fairly aggressively, we also have a growing population of men who are non-metastatic castrate resistant. So what do we mean by castrate resistance? All it simply means is progressive disease, be it a rising PSA or a rising PSA plus metastasis, in the face of castrate serum testosterone levels. Really, that's all it means. So, you know, all the old terms of hormone sensitive, hormone dependent, I mean, those are all gone. This is a much more precise definition, because really what you're doing is you're manipulating the AR axis to get castrate serum testosterone levels, and you have progressive disease. And because of the fact that you treat earlier, we have both non-metastatic castrate-sensitive disease and non-metastatic castrate-resistant disease, and there's really no standard of care or standard approved therapy in either of these spaces. Okay. However, if you have metastatic disease, but if you're asymptomatic, I think still most of us would treat, but it's a little controversial. But once somebody is metastatic and symptomatic, there's no debate. And also, if you are castrate-sensitive and metastatic, again, you know, still the recommendations are that you treat. So most drug development is pitched in this space, meaning metastatic castrate-resistant disease, which has failed everything. So remember, in the past, multiple chemotherapy trials had been negative, and so there was really nothing to offer once somebody was metastatic and castrate-resistant, and median survival was 12 to 15 months. Now, in the last 10 years, because of all the different things that we have, it's probably almost up to 4 years now. Now, obviously, you know, it varies. I mean, people have different biologies, and that's why I put 12 to 48 months. Probably, the actual number is 24 to 48 months. Okay? So that is for metastatic castrate resistant. Okay? And we used to, once people have failed that, then chemotherapy got approved first. But then we developed other novel AR manipulating agents, and they were in the post-chemotherapy space. But once they got approved there, now they're actually used even before chemotherapy. So the sequencing is you do standard hormonal therapy. Once you become castrate resistant, you go through novel hormonal therapy. I'm staying away from the word second-line hormonal therapy because that's been used in a different connotation in the past. So basically, you use new AR active agents, and once you fail that, you get chemotherapy. Okay. Okay. So again, I'm backtracking now. I'm back to the natural history of a rising PSA. So this is men who have failed local therapy, and the only thing they have is a rising PSA. And again, this is a group from Hopkins, over 2,000 men, about 15% relapsed. And what you found in these men was that, on an average, it took 8 years from the first rise of PSA for them to develop a positive bone scan, and another 5 years to die. So this paper is, it's actually a classic. It's a natural history of PSA-only disease. So these are men who were only treated once they had painful bone metastasis. You know, this study would clearly never be done again, but this was done at Hopkins. So the one thing you have to know about the Hopkins subset is they were super selective about whom they treated. Only 8% of men in this group had Gleason 8 and above. So they picked winners. The second thing about this group was, the Hopkins group, is they've always been very anti-hormones. I mean, that's just, because, hormones have all sorts of side effects. And so they've always been against that. And that's the reason they were able to do this study. So a recent analysis, what they showed was that actually you can predict how somebody is going to progress by their PSA doubling time. Now, just want to caution you about PSA doubling times. To really interpret them meaningfully, you have to have a real number, and a real number is 1. So I think it's meaningless trying to interpret PSA slopes from the PSA going up from 0.001 to 0.005, 006, especially now that we have supersensitive assays. So to really get a clinically meaningful interpretation, you have to have a whole number, and that's what this is based on. So men who have a PSA doubling time of more than 9 months, they tend to have an indolent course and we leave them alone. So this is all non-metastatic disease. Over 15 months, you know, again, you kind of leave them alone. We're not quite sure what to do with men with a PSA doubling time of 3 to 9 months, but most clinical trials are pitched in this space. Because see, if you take all comers and you put them on clinical trials, this is such a heterogeneous group, I don't think you'll get meaningful results. So most of these folks should go on a clinical trial when available. And if the PSA doubling time is less than 3 months, all of us recognize that is aggressive disease. It's a matter of time before they develop metastasis, and these people wind up going on hormone therapy. So at least that's what we do as of today. So the other thing that's being debated is, since we are still at this, at the topic of high-risk disease. So remember, in prostate cancer, the way the current staging is based, if you're node positive, it's actually metastatic disease. But clearly, you know, a single node is not the same as having bone mets. So what the debate has been is, if you have advanced prostate cancer, and again, the word advanced here is a very loose term, does local treatment, meaning treating the primary, impact treatment? And the answer is yes. Because again, this is a randomized study done in Europe where they looked at either hormone therapy alone or a combination of hormone and radiation. And clearly the overall survival, 10-year overall survival, there was about a 6% difference, which was highly statistically significant. This is again along the same line. So when I said locally advanced, that was local nodes positive. Metastatic would mean either more than one or two nodes, or maybe oligometastasis. And this study was again done in Europe, and you kind of get the same result. So if you look at the cohort of men who did not have metastasis with radiation alone, this was the survival. With hormones alone, this was a survival when you added radiation. It's proportion event-free, and it's about 38%. And again, the same thing, if they were node positive, again, there's a benefit to adding radiation to hormones. So this is a little counter to what we talked about earlier, you know, meaning less is more. But I think at least for high-risk or locally advanced disease, at least my personal bias is, you know, you have this one good shot at making a meaningful impact. And so even if the horse is slightly outside the barn, I think there's a lot of merit to burning the barn down, meaning radiating the primary organ. Again, it's controversial. Not everybody buys that. Till this trial, which was presented recently, there was really no randomized trials available. In fact, in the setting of surgery, there still aren't, but you can extend the same notion to surgery. So in other words, if you have somebody who's node positive, I think, the dictum has been, if you go in to operate, and at the time of surgery, you find somebody's node positive, you close up and you don't remove the prostate. So people are actually looking at the data, aborted prostatectomy versus completed, and actually the survival is better on patients who had the primary removed. So radiation literature, there is more evidence to support this. In the surgical literature, the evidence is evolving. Okay. I think this is along the same lines, so I'm going to skip that. But again, Okay, so we've been harping about endocrine therapy or hormone therapy. So what do I mean by that? So now the main thing that drives prostate cancer is testosterone or androgens and the androgen receptor, which is kind of depicted here. And so you can interfere with this at a number of different places. So standard or first-line hormonal therapy really is blocking the testes, which you can do, you can either remove them or you can block them with the LHRH agonist. Now, in the past, people also used to use estrogens to do the same. But with estrogens, there's like a 20% incidence of cardiovascular events, or sorry, DVTs, or peripheral vascular events. And that's why they kind of fail. So we've been using LHRH agonists. The difference between LHRH agonists and an orchiectomy is you can turn this off, whereas this, you know, once it's gone, it's gone. Okay. And once you have testosterone, it enters the cytoplasm. It gets converted to DHT by 5-alpha reductase, and then it binds to the androgen receptor, and the complex translocates to the nucleus and turns on AR-dependent genes. And so what we do initially is we either do orchiectomy or use an LHRH agonist. At least for a couple of weeks, you kind of do that in combination with an anti-androgen. And the reason you do that is with LHRH agonists, initially you can actually cause a testosterone flare. But within 2 weeks, the testosterone is down and then kind of keeps on coming down. And so what we normally do is we'll do that for 2 weeks clinically. Then you, at about 4 to 5 weeks, you check the baseline testosterone level. If it's less than 50 nanograms per deciliter, you don't need an anti-androgen. You can save it for later. Whereas if it's in the 40-50 ballpark, then you kind of go ahead and add an anti-androgen because you may get a benefit. Or you can follow the PSA. If it's not coming down, you can add the anti-androgen. Okay. So basically, what we mean by androgen deprivation therapy is any treatment that blocks interaction of androgens with the androgen receptor. It could be, so you can either remove the ligand, which would be an orchiectomy, or LHRH agonists. There are also a few LHRH antagonists which have kind of made it into the market. So the pitch for them is that you don't get the testosterone flare, but they cost much more and they're a little harder to give. There's a slightly higher incidence of hypersensitivity reaction, so the uptake with them has not been that huge. Estrogens are largely gone. I mean, they had two big disadvantages. They caused the deep vein thrombosis, plus they were much, much cheaper compared to LHRH agonists. So, you know, in our world, that's hard then to justify it, at least not right now. And then some people have also used anti-androgen monotherapy. But all these therapies, they do not adequately suppress adrenal or intratumoral production of androgen. So you can have castrate serum testosterone levels, but you could still have significant input either from the adrenals, biologically speaking, or from intratumoral production of androgens, which you can't measure in the serum. Okay? So at least as of now, these are the only indications for androgen deprivation therapy. So again, it's misused a lot as well. So one is newly diagnosed metastatic disease. This one is controversial, but at least, you know, where I train and practice, we did this all the time. Adjuvant therapy of node-positive disease discovered at prostatectomy, and then combined with radiation therapy either for 2 to 3 years in high-risk disease or for 6 months in intermediate-risk disease. And use of androgen deprivation therapy in patients with biochemical progression is controversial. Probably the only indication at this point is in patients with a PSA doubling time of less than 3 months. Okay. I'm going to skip this. Okay. So I think I'm going to make a shift now to metastatic prostate cancer, and this is castrate sensitive. Okay. So the main points I want to make here are, you know, survival has been changing. So in the 80s, it was 31 months or 3 years. Sorry. And again, in the late 80s, it was 33 months, so still again around 3 years. But in the last decade or the last 15 years, it's been more like 4 years. Now, whether it's just stage migration, meaning you're treating people earlier, so you've gone from 3 to 4 years, or whether we've used something more powerful is unclear. I personally think it's just stage migration, because this only reflects data using either an orchiectomy or LHRH agonist plus or minus anti-androgens. Okay. So that's the baseline that we're kind of dealing with. The other thing was, there was this big debate, should you use androgens continuously or should you use them intermittently? And this was the study which kind of settled that issue. And basically, for metastatic disease, you need to use continuous androgen deprivation therapy. The whole reason intermittent became famous or kind of took a life of its own was because, again, on this study, they felt that the level of PSA at 8 months after initiation of androgen deprivation therapy was prognostic. And this is the data. And what it showed was, if at 8 months after starting treatment, your PSA was less than 0.2, the median survival was 75 months. If it was in this group, it was 44 months. And if it was more than 4, it was 13 months. And again, this has been validated in other studies as well. So the notion was, if you treat for 8 months, you get the PSA down, you can hold the hormones, and you can restart treatment as and when the PSA went up. And arbitrarily, the cutoff they used was 4 or 5. But when finally the data from this study was analyzed, it was actually found the continuous therapy arm had about a 5 or 6% survival advantage. So these are the studies which looked at continuous versus intermittent androgen deprivation therapy. So these are all phase 3 studies. Now, in the setting of biochemical failures or PSA-only disease with a rapid doubling time, there, whether you do it intermittently or continuously, does not seem to impact survival. So in that situation, it's okay. And the way we treat there is we treat for 6 to 8 months. On this study, they only treated for 6 months. You stop, and as the PSA goes up, you retreat again. And the whole idea was that this may be better for quality of life, which it probably is. But in the metastatic setting, the recommendations are continuous treatment. So then I think in the last 10, 15 years, the other thing that came up was, can we improve on this? And based on initial data from chemotherapy, what they wanted to test was adding chemotherapy. And the standard chemotherapy here is docetaxel, which is the taxane, which is a tubulin inhibitor. And that was compared to androgen deprivation therapy. And what they found on this was, there was a significant survival advantage. So overall, in men who only got hormones, median survival was 44 months. So this is again very similar to what I showed you a few slides ago. And if they also got chemotherapy in addition, the median survival was 57 months. And I think this translated to a 15% survival advantage. They also did a subset analysis, and the benefit was clearly more in patients who had high volume disease, so 49 months versus 32 months. And in the low volume disease, we don't have a final answer, but all the data is not mature, but it still seems like maybe in low volume disease there's no benefit to adding chemotherapy. So at least the new standard of care for high volume metastatic disease is both hormones continuously and chemotherapy for 6 cycles, which is roughly 4 months, since you do it every 3 weeks. Okay. So I think this is an important slide. So what are the side effects of androgen deprivation therapy? And you can split them up into the big three, which is loss of libido, erectile dysfunction, hot flashes, and then what you see, which is weight gain, gynecomastia, loss of muscle strength, change in size of the sex organs. What you don't see, and that's the metabolic stuff. So this is bones, this is anemia, and this is all the cardiovascular stuff. And recently, there's actually been a lot of interest in basic cognition, depression, emotional ability, etc., etc. So one other interesting thing is, if you look at bone, it seems like most of the bad things seem to happen after 12 months. So what we mean by 1 to 4 doses here is the way we give the agonist is every 12 weeks or every 3 months. So at 1 to 4 doses, if you look at bone mineral density, it does go down, but not profoundly. But, once you hit 5 to 8 doses, so when you go from year 1 to year 2, it's worse, and more than 2 years, seems to be much, much worse. So that's why, at least in the high-risk disease, I think since we're trying to figure out what's the optimal duration of hormone therapy, you know, we know 6 months isn't good enough, we know 2 years is good, and the question is if we could get it down further, could we decrease some of this morbidity or not? I mean, that's unclear. The other thing is that this is a recent paper on risk for, you know, Alzheimer's disease as well as, you know, general cognitive problems. And again, there seems to be something magical about 12 months. So the incidence of cognitive problems is much more in men exposed to androgen deprivation therapy for more than 12 months. Now again, I think this is much, much more relevant in high-risk disease. I think for advanced and metastatic disease, it's kind of already settled that to do continuous hormone therapy is advantageous. I think the only thing, you know, the only big thing that could happen there is if you could develop agents which are, you know, which can only attack AR in the cancer. So, you know, so-called selective androgen receptor modulators. Okay. I think I went over the definition of castrate-resistant disease, which is, you know, progressive disease despite castrate serum testosterone levels, which are defined as either less than 50 nanograms per deciliter. There's also another unit in use, which is less than 1.7 nanomoles per deciliter. So you just have to be careful about what unit you're actually seeing. So these are the mechanisms of castrate-resistant disease. You have persistent androgens in primary tumors, persistent androgens in metastasis, upregulated enzymes of steroidogenesis. So this could almost be a 10 to 15-fold upregulation. So basically, the substrate is the same or same amount, but the end, you know, the end product is far, far more. Or you can have problems with AR signaling, either amplification, and this actually has turned out to be a big thing for resistance, which are AR splice variants. So, you know, usually you need the ligand, i.e. androgen or whatever, to bind to the receptor for it to translocate to the nucleus, but in the setting of variants, you lose the C-terminal end, and these variants can translocate to the nucleus without a ligand. So they can go in independently. And even when we treat CRPC or castrate-resistant prostate cancer, splice variants are a problem. And then you can have signaling via alternate ligands, or you can have signaling via, you know, other pathways. Okay. I think I'm going to... let me know when you want me to stop. It's like only 20 minutes. So I think, should I just scroll down towards the end? So the newer hormonal agents are either CYP17 inhibitors or more powerful antiandrogens. And the prototype there is enzalutamide. So I think if you look at binding affinity at the AR, the one that was used a lot, bicalutamide, before this became available, it binds to the AR, you know, 1,000-fold less avidly than DHT, which is the natural ligand. Even enzalutamide, its binding affinity is 100-fold less than DHT. So we made progress, but clearly there's a lot to be done with AR binding affinities. I mean, it's a more potent AR blocker, but clearly there's room for improvement. And CYP17 inhibitors basically shut down or abrogate androgen biosynthesis. So again, as you know, all hormones are derived from cholesterol. You know, they're converted to progesterones, and they can either go down to the corticoid pathway or they can go the androgen pathway. And what the CYP17 inhibitors do, they basically block these hydroxylases and the 720 lyase. So here is abiraterone, which is the approved agent for blocking this pathway. And it blocks 17 alpha hydroxylase and C17-20 lyase, so you block it fairly proximally in this pathway. Now, this is actually a pretty interesting agent. It's broken down into other substrates. You know, there's a D4A, there is a abiraterone 5 alpha and 5 beta, and actually 5 alpha and 5 beta are AR agonists. And only D4A is an AR antagonist. So one of the mechanisms of resistance here is you know, some of the end products can actually serve as AR agonists. So people respond to this, but eventually they do become resistant to that. So enzalutamide is, again, it's supposed to have multiple actions. So first of all, it competes with DHT to bind to the AR, but again, it's less avid than DHT. It also blocks the translocation into the nucleus. And I'm not sure this is really proven, but at least the company claims it can also inhibit association of the AR with the DNA. But again, I'm not 100% sure that that's true. But the other two do seem to be true. I think I'm going to just skip through all this. So I think at least if you look at the prostate cancer landscape as of today, you have newly diagnosed disease, and you can do one of three things for localized disease: either surgery or radiation or active surveillance. And clearly for intermediate or high-risk disease, you would add androgen deprivation therapy. For a rising PSA, it's usually observation, but perhaps androgen deprivation therapy for the less than 3-month PSA doublers. In the hormone-naive metastatic setting, you know, we tend to use chemotherapy along with hormones. There's no standard second line here. And in this space, so in the metastatic chemotherapy-naive asymptomatic, you can either use a vaccine, which has got about a 4-month survival advantage. You can use enzalutamide. You can use abiraterone. You can use chemotherapy. Then in the second line, if they haven't seen chemotherapy, they can get either docetaxel, or they can get RAD223, which is a bone homing radioactive agent. And then you also have another second line chemotherapy. But then again, there's this space, you know, where men have failed everything. They still have progressive disease, and about 30% of them do tend to have DNA repair defects. I mean, for the lack of a better word, BRCNS of the tumor. And in that setting, there's a recent study where about 16 people were treated with a PARP inhibitor, and 14 of them did respond to that. But so, you know, drug development is kind of pitched in this area, and this area. The problem with this area is it's going to take a long time to show a survival advantage. So it's hard to get products into that environment. It's also true here, and that's why most of everything is pitched here. So I think you can go through some of these slides, and you can, you know, email me with questions. I already mentioned, you know, we discussed this paper already, but the other paper is looking at the genomics of advanced prostate cancer, which also came out this year. And this is the one I wanted to... So here really what they did was, so it was a group of institutions with funding from the Prostate Cancer Foundation. They basically did biopsy patients with metastatic CRPC who had kind of failed all therapies, for the lack of a better word. Now remember, just given the distribution of disease, 54% of this was actually from bone. And this is not always very interpretable for what you want to look at. So there were like 220 patients biopsied. I mean, this is actually a huge and hard undertaking, but in only half of them was the data interpretable. And in them, what they found was 13% after all this treatment had classic neuroendocrine type of histology. 26% had an intermediate or atypical kind of histology distinct from adenocarcinoma and from a neuroendocrine phenotype. And 26% had distinct but mixed qualities. And they're kind of outlined here. But what they found was, if after all this treatment, you had typical adenocarcinoma, your survival was about 2 years. So remember now, this is metastatic, castrate-resistant, having failed everything, where on the first slide or initial slide I show you, median survival is less than 12 months. But, you know, with all the treatment, it's probably extended to like 2 years. But again, this is a heterogeneous population. If the folks they biopsied had the small cell or that intermediate phenotype, median survival was only 11 months. So it's very hard to study this population because most of them, what they have is bone metastasis. You can biopsy those. A, it's not easy to do. And B, even if you do it, there's no guarantee you will get interpretable data. So one of the other things people have started looking at is circulating tumor cells. And that's where they were looking for DNA repair defects. And again, I think I mentioned this paper earlier. But to go back to the circulating tumor cells, based on CTC, you can actually predict survival. So if you have a high number, your two-year survival is low. If it's a low number of cells, sorry, if you have less than five, then your two-year survival is 46%. But if you have more than five cells, with defects, it's only 2%. So again, these are kind of new. This is new stuff. It's being validated. The other thing what they found was they went back and looked at CTCs, and what they were looking in CTCs was the ARV7 spliced variant, which is now being kind of validated as being present in a number of people with resistant disease. And then they went back and looked at data in people who had failed abiraterone or failed enzalutamide and who had failed taxane. And what you can see is it correlates very well. So the failures are kind of, here. And what you find is it correlates very well with the ARV7 splice variant. So because of all the problems with bone biopsies and trying to biopsy other sites, at least in resistant, at least in people who have been extensively treated, I think following CTCs is valid. There's actually a commercial assay available through Celldex. And you can also, in these CTCs, assay ARV7. Which is the splice variant of the androgen receptor, and you can also so this is validated, and you can also assay them for BRCNS, which is still experimental but not validated. But I think as we go forward, I think probably CTCs are going to be the main way, at least in this heavily pretreated population, to try to get an idea of what their genomic profile is. So I know I kind of really breezed through the last stuff, but I guess if we have some conclusions from the whole thing, so widespread screening is out, and maybe there may be a role for more, targeted screening, or as some people say, intelligent screening. Active surveillance is safe and dissociates screening from treatment. Local therapy for prostate cancer in all non-metastatic patients may also be beneficial in metastatic. So I'm kind of going from early to more advanced disease. Chemotherapy in metastatic prostate cancer is here to stay. Abiraterone and enzalutamide, the first line for most gastrate-resistant patients, may actually start being used even earlier and may give you a better survival. And then personalization and new targeted therapies may be on the way, but clearly they are going to be people who have failed everything else. Then I'll stop there and be happy to take questions. And again, I know I rushed through the last part. If you have any questions, feel free to email me.